Yes, it's the little things. Yes, it's the little things that do us harm.
Hey, folks.
Hello.
Welcome to this installment of the Farm Report.
It's Friday.
That means it's the Farm Report.
Heather here.
Lorenzo. Adam Horwich.
How you doing?
Ben Fallner. Ben Flanner, excuse me. We are in Bushwick broadcasting from underneath a rooftop garden, so we couldn't think of more apropos guests than some of the city's leading rooftop agriculturalists.
Thank you.
And so Ben is working on the Greenpoint Rooftop Farm, is that right?
Yes.
Which has been all over the news. If you read the newspaper or read New York Magazine, you've probably come across it. And Adam is working on an avant-garde kiddie pool rooftop gardening technique that he's going to share with us. And he's working as a consultant, and he's working and he's teaching classes. But basically, we have two of the personalities at the forefront of what will soon become the newest extension of American agriculture into the urban landscape. So why don't you guys tell us, Ben, why don't you tell me how you went from E-Trade, which is seemingly E-Trade marketing, which couldn't be more dissimilar from what you're doing now, to your current enterprise, which is blowing up.
Well, I studied engineering. That was my background. Finished college about 5 or 6 years ago. And I've worked in a series of jobs that both required a fair amount of math and stuff like that. But I've always been really interested in food, and basically for the past 2 years or so, I've been kind of just carefully plotting my next move. You know, keep an eye out for opportunities or whatever.
I knew intended there with the plot.
Plotting, planting the seeds. But I knew I'd end up doing something different and keeping an eye out for things. And I was very interested in food. I've been canning, pickling, making hot sauce. Making salsa for a long time, making bitters, doing cocktail parties and underground supper clubs and stuff like
really?
That. So for someone that knew me, it wasn't quite as random of a move as it might sound like on paper.
Right,
sure,
definitely.
Sure. What about you, Adam?
Well, I guess, my background is not directly involved in farming or anything like that until about 3 years ago. And before that, I was working at this PR company in Midtown, and sort of similar to Ben, I guess. And I've always been interested in food and environmental issues and sort of urban planning. And I was part of a Peak Oil group and in New York City, and we put together a conference. And I learned about permaculture at the conference. This was in 2006 in the spring at Cooper Union. And permaculture is—it's a regenerative design system. I think that's the best way to describe it.
Okay.
And one of the things that these permaculturalists talked about was rooftop gardening, rooftop farming, and the potential for it. And so I just sort of got bit by a bug at that point, and I went off that summer and studied permaculture in Ithaca. And
I used to live in Ithaca.
Oh, okay.
Never looked back.
Yeah, and it's And there, that was one of the places that was, you know, back 3 years ago even, it wasn't as common, permaculture design courses and stuff. Now
I
they have it in the
gorgeous.
City. That's what the t-shirts say. The,
so
a trendy t-shirt.
So basically permaculture might be a synonym for sustainable farming.
Yeah, that's part of permaculture. It's,
okay, what are some of the other, assume I know nothing, for the layperson, what does permaculture mean?
Permaculture, it started in Australia in the 70s, and it's still, that's where it's strongest, is Australia, New Zealand, I think, is where it's sort of more of a, you know, common notion over there. And it started as permanent agriculture. And but now other aspects of culture have sort of been infused into it, so it's really permanent culture. People talk about permaculture, like architecture and, you know, alternative monetary systems and stuff like that.
So it's become a model for sustainable economy, sustainable agriculture, sustainable building.
Yeah, and sustainable, and they say it's beyond sustainable, it, you know, regenerates. So it's like sustainability.
So its own existence, its own existence prepares for and allows for its persistence, its continuation.
Yeah, it's about, you know, human beings having a positive influence, you know, on the environment, rather than sort of this choice between being, you know, negative polluters and being like, no impact, do nothing, you know. It's sort of that you can have this, you can be just as positive as we have been negative in the past.
So it's super green.
Yeah, that's it definitely appeals to people who want to be super green, I think.
I gotcha. So Ben, why don't you tell us a little bit about how you started this project? I mean, it's such a massive undertaking.
Sure.
Which we've even yet to mention the title of. What is the title of your project?
It's called Rooftop Farms.
Rooftop Farms in Greenpoint, Brooklyn, that is?
Greenpoint, Brooklyn. Yep. It's on Eagle Street in the northwest corner of Greenpoint, which is a great community to start a project like this. I found all the neighbors have been really supportive and enthusiastic, and people have been stopping by, and restaurants
all over the papers
and coffee shops. Yeah.
As soon as I tried to scratch the surface of it, it was like, boom, a list of New York Times articles, New York Magazine articles. I mean, I'm not surprised that this has caught so much attention. Yeah. It's such a revolutionary idea.
Yeah, and to be honest, the attention and the energy and the enthusiasm from people has been very motivating to keep me, you know, to keep me motivated. We're getting emails from people just with really congratulatory, really positive words, and it
That's
feels
awesome.
Good, you know.
Of course.
It definitely drives.
You're doing something you can feel good about, and you're providing a service for the community and yourself and, you know, the environment as a whole. So
yeah.
Now, where does your rooftop garden sit above?
Well, it sits above a warehouse.
A warehouse.
It's owned by Broadway Stages, which is a film and lighting company, staging company in Greenpoint. They own several properties. And yeah, they were generous enough to provide the resources to put up the soil on the roof. And
did you pitch them or did they pitch you? Like, how did you guys meet?
Well, I guess, well, to back up a notch, mm-hmm. Into last summer, I became very interested in agriculture. And like I was just saying, I was very interested in food for a while, and started visiting lots of farms and just really feeling the life and the vitality, you know, just looking at everything from the mini ecosystems, the circular systems, and started reading books about agriculture and farming, and decided around, I suppose, late last summer that I wanted to work on a farm this year. Actually, it was through a lot of support of really good friends. I really have to credit them for changing my mind that, like, I wasn't really ready to leave New York either.
Mm-hmm.
So I became really just digging around and brainstorming ideas and making little jot lists of, like, how could I do some urban farming? And I had done a little bit of urban, I'd say, gardening in the East Village last summer, and it was also very motivating as well, although it was, mm-hmm. you know, just like...
Just doing it yourself, like actually seeing something, like, you know, create and mm-hmm. be able to then taste it or look at it afterwards, all
yeah.
that.
Just yeah, it was fun. So, and then it was a well-timed email that I sent to Good Green, which is a green
rooftop.
Yeah, we
spoke to Annie.
Annie, yeah.
Yeah, on Green, that's who she works with, right?
Yeah, well, yeah. Annie works with me, but Good Green is the company that installed the rooftop.
Uh-huh.
And they have a really awesome green roof on their place in Soho in Manhattan. And they started a business, I believe, last summer, developing other roofs. Basically saying this, I think the conversation they had was like, this is so fun, and it would be, there's a huge environmental benefit, especially to the city in terms
sure.
of dealing with sewage, runoff, water, and everything. So they started a business, and then they got some great PR last summer. I saw one of them and saw an article and emailed them, and they responded within a day. And my email said, I'm interested in what you do, but I'm thinking about a scaled down version, you know, without any architects involved, without anything fancy, just putting down soil on top of a green roof and then farming it. Totally productive and, you know, more on the efficient side, like farming. And they had been coincidentally thinking about the same thing, responded very quickly, and then we had some meetings, and they had already been in touch with Broadway Stages. Broadway Stages had expressed
okay.
interest in doing a green roof.
Oh.
They hadn't worked out all the details or anything, but then as a function of the conversations we had and you know, other concurring events, the green roof that Broadway Stages was thinking about putting up evolved into, let's just farm it, and then... you know, then the farmers will take care of all the maintenance of the roof, and then we'll just leave them alone and see if we're basically attempting to try to see if we can create like something that's viable to continue on into the future, where you can pay yourself off of what you can sell.
Aside from just eat.
Yeah, aside from feed yourself.
So the city is trying to implement countless green roofs around Manhattan and the outer boroughs, but this performs the double function of farming and green roof. I mean, it absorbs rainfall, it insulates the building, right? It performs every function that a normal green roof would, plus provides food. Is that right?
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, it's a little bit more demanding on the soil, and it requires a lot of labor and you know, other things associated with farming. But, yeah, it has tons of different benefits to the community if we can make it work. So last fall, when I started talking to Good Green, I got in touch with Annie Novak, who you just mentioned a second ago. And we've partnered up on the project, and we're making it happen so far.
Awesome. So, Adam, when you install one of your kiddie pool roofs, I mean, does that make the roof green, or does it make it sort of half green in terms of water absorption and insulation? Or what's the difference between the kind of project that you do and Ben's?
I guess, you know, there's a lot of differences. There's a lot of similarities. It depends how you define green, you know, and what your goals are. And I think that the more intensively you plant a roof, sort of the deeper the soil, the more vigorous plants that you have up on the roof, the more green it gets. And generally, food crops are some of the most aggressive, most vigorous you know, plants we have. So it's really growing food crops really makes the roof function like a green roof should. A lot of the green roofs being planted now don't do what they're advertised as doing, you know.
Really?
A lot of them.
So it's just a flimsy trend or a flimsy
fad. it's all you know, relative. And I think that, but you know, green roofs that are planted with very thin soils, just a couple inches, planted with sedums, which are like high altitude succulents, you know, they're sort of advertised as, you know, zero maintenance. And it seems like what people are trying to do is, you know, retain and or detain water for stormwater runoff and then cool the building down and, you know, and cool the surrounding area down. Those are sort of the three main things green roofs are supposed to do. And, you know, these types of green roofs don't really work that well in any of those levels, especially cooling down the building.
Who are the people that are trying to kind of like half-ass it? Are these like landlords or supers? Or?
I mean, I don't really know. I mean, I just know that there's a lot of interest in this. These things are getting built very quickly. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't build it. It doesn't mean that it won't do some of these things. It won't do it, you know, it won't be like, it's not like a, you know, it won't have some benefit. But, you know, it's quite expensive. And, you know, if you're... Basically, one of the reasons I think that they're not functioning the way they should is because they're being sold as sort of maintenance-free. And you don't even have to, you know, you can look at it sometimes. You don't even have to go up there. You shouldn't walk on it, you know.
Is anything really maintenance-free?
I mean, it's they are low maintenance. You know, they are relatively, you know, you don't have to go up there a lot. And you don't have to water it, you know, supposedly. And but the thing is, I think that that's not the way it, I think it should be sold as something that people should be involved with and they should take some responsibility for. And if people are willing to go up there, even just like once a week, like, you know, if you have an apartment building or an office building or something, and, you know, you could easily get some people to go up there, you know, once every couple of days, do a little watering, just,
I
you know,
maintain I wish I had
it.
Access to my roof.
Yeah, you know, there's so many people who would be who'd love to do that. And so I think that then you can grow food crops, you can have, you know, local native grasses and things like things that are just will do more of the I'm specifically talking about the cooling properties of green roofs, you know, that'll sort of basically something that uses more water will cool faster. And these sort of high altitude desert plants, they're designed for an environment with not a lot of water. So they don't need a lot of water, but they won't use a lot of water either. So they won't, you know, cool the building down like, you know, the way people expect them to.
So basically the greenest kind of roof is a rooftop farm.
I think
in not only in the sense that it performs the normal functions of a green roof, but it also allows for the city to go locavore.
Yeah, it's just that much on top of it, of the whole system.
Right.
Definitely.
Yeah. So you were talking about the expenses of green roofs and the price. Why do you think that last year seemed to be the biggest boom year for urban farming and for green roofs in a time of economic slowdown? How do you reconcile those two seemingly disparate?
I think it's all part of partially why people are blaming the economic slowdown, and you know, and it's partially because of really blown up consumerism and lack of regard for sustainability issues, particularly energy is probably the the biggest buzzword there.
It's backlash.
And yeah, I think it's partially backlash, and it's people becoming really aware of the fact that that they're going to have to change their habits. And you know, all these small incremental things, once people really start getting momentum towards them, then they'll really start to add up.
Yeah, I mean, it's so important for people to kind of retaliate against what they don't know. And if you don't know where your food is coming from, I mean, what do you know? This is something you're putting into your body every day.
Yeah, in terms of, and that's a whole nother, you know, issue is the food and industrialization and mass production of food, and then also green roofs, but they're all connected.
Definitely. So you think in sort of a counterintuitive way, the economic slowdown has inculcated into people's heads the fact that the current status quo might be highly erroneous.
Definitely.
And therefore, that has had a trickle down effect and has made them consider these previously radical ideas.
Yeah, I think
such as urban farms. So in a way,
yeah, it sounds very logical.
So it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like an organism damaging one part of its body and then reinforcing it through healing.
Makes sense.
Yeah. So how would someone else get started? What do you think? What do you guys think? How do you get people started when you teach? Like, what do you teach? How does?
Well, I mean, it's let's say you live, you know, in an apartment building in New York, you know, Manhattan, Brooklyn, Queens, wherever, and you do have access to your roof. You can go up there with an $8 little plastic kiddie pool, as long as it's not the inflatable kind, you know, the hard plastic. You get them at Toys R Us, and you can take some, and you get that. Then you get some lightweight soil. You can buy that, you know, at a garden center. I use like 50% perlite, which is, you know, I mean, this it's maybe not the best way to go, the most sustainable, the sort of gold standard, but it's easy to get, relatively inexpensive. And then I put, you know, you could do like another quarter peat moss and then another quarter compost, and you can play around with it. And then you can plant, you know, basically almost any annual vegetable that we eat, you know, from tomatoes to melons to eggplants, lettuce, you know, everything.
So basically for about $50, people can set up a kiddie pool, fill it with soil, spend another $10 on seeds, and then they get a pretty large medley of vegetables.
Yeah.
And at the roof, Annie teaches workshops every Sunday on urban gardening, urban farming, urban vegetable growing. And we've been getting great turnouts to it. And in line with that, you know, she addresses, you just have to look at your lighting situation. You can do this on a balcony. You can do it in a window. There's several different levels.
Yeah, until you get the notice from the, like, super that they're going to throw everything off the fire escape.
You just have to ignore that.
I know. I've tried. And then my plants disappeared.
But yeah, if you're resourceful, you can really grow. You can definitely grow vegetables in a pretty small amount of area with a reasonable amount of effort as well.
Do you guys have like an email list or a website some people can sign up to see when these workshops or how they happen?
Yes, definitely. For the farm, you can go to www.rooftopfarms.org, and it's pretty easy to find the email. And the email is rooftopfarmer@gmail.com.
Cool. And then our listeners can then maybe come and visit and join Annie for some of these workshops and get started with their own.
Yeah, definitely.
Cool.
We have volunteer days at most Sundays.
Most Sundays. Mm-hmm. Except for when you want to get out of the city.
Except for when we're on vacation.
Yeah, nice.
So Heather was mentioning that sometimes landlords show some resistance to these projects, but I was actually reading that tide also seems to be turning, and that landlords are now more open to these ideas. Is that accurate, Adam? I mean,
that's something that I'm not, people ask me, you know, I give them all these sort of technical explanations on, like, you know, if you combine plants together, you know, you can double your yield by doing three-dimensional gardening and all these different things. And they're like, that's great. How do I convince my landlord to let me do this? And I'm like, well, you know,
forget
that's a good question. Like, I couldn't originally do it on my roof either, you know, so it's,
how'd you get your landlord?
I did it on somebody else's roof.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, did you just do it and see what happens?
Yeah. I mean, that's one way to go about it. Yeah. I'm not sure I could recommend that, you know.
No, I know. But we're not telling anyone to go just do it, but yeah.
I wouldn't be surprised about that fact, though. I feel like it's definitely a clear tide. Yeah, like as you said, a change of the tide, and any landlord in his right mind that isn't, you know, too paranoid about lawsuits and stuff will just say, yeah, go grow some vegetables. It's great for the building.
It'll, yeah. And if they like to tenant. Eat, we could give them, you know, a little throwback once it's ready to harvest.
Yeah, totally.
You know,
I mean, originally when I first started hearing about rooftop gardens, I was like, okay, so how does the soil and the water not just like leak through the roof? You know, obviously you as an engineer who, you know, before you started all this, like, thought about these issues. And I know upstairs from where we are broadcasting right now, we've got a rooftop garden and they laid down rails and they've got planter boxes. I mean,
yeah, raised beds.
Something has to happen to keep from the roof from caving in.
How do you equip a roof to be gardened?
Well, the roof that we're working on required no structural supplements. The beams, the I-beams that were already in the roof were strong enough. And Good Green, the installation company, put in the green roof, which includes a level of roof stop, like a hard plastic, and then a water collection system, which is basically like discs, almost like little mini hockey pucks in a bed of plastic, and then a couple layers of felt below and above that, and then the soil just right above that.
Yeah.
So that protects the roof, basically, with the roof step, and they used a certified structural engineer to give the sign-off that it could hold the weight.
Oh.
And how much weight? We're talking about maybe thousands of tons, right?
Yeah, a couple hundred thousand pounds.
Oh, wow.
And basically...
How'd you get it up there?
A crane.
No
yeah.
way.
Yeah, they rented a crane for a day, blocked off the street on West Street, right off the water. And for 2 days, there were 62 sacks that each weighed almost 4,000 pounds of rooftop soil.
That is badass.
Each one on its own pallet. They came up in a tractor trailer from Pennsylvania.
That's sick. There's,
yeah.
It must have given you a nice feeling of satisfaction to see something like that actually start to take shape.
Yeah, it was a really exciting day. Just, you know,
When was this?
That was April 24th, I believe.
Oh, wow. 24 days after we got started over here. So then
2009's a big year.
Yeah, big year.
Things are exploding. If I had my sound effect on, I would just give it a big boom right now.
So how many people did it take to lay this soil, to sort of seed it, to...
Well, they had a crew for that day of installing the roof. And then basically turned it over to us, the farmers, the day after, which I guess would be the 25th. And then we had a slew of friends, and actually it was almost all friends, maybe a couple of volunteers that we didn't know yet, just that had emailed us that had heard rumor of the project.
Sweet.
And like that was such a great omen, you know, like the day when we really needed people, we didn't even ask anyone explicitly to come.
People just come to you.
Just told them we'd be working on it. Luckily, it was a Saturday. And we had like that was the last weekend in April when it got to be like 90. So we had like, you know, eight people have them at their shirts off and just shoveling.
I think I remember that weekend.
Shoveling dirt and shoveled out the walkways. And we had four big sacks of wood chips. And in a day and a half, we had all the beds sculpted out. And then the next day, we were putting in the peas. And, you know,
you
just
had to start those early, right?
Exactly.
The peas is one of the first crops you got to plant, right?
By late April, we were none too early, actually. But the very forgiving May and June that we had were very good to the peas. So it all worked out.
Thanks.
So how did you protect yourself against something going wrong? I mean, this is the kind of project that you sink so much money into that you have to have like all your T's crossed and all your I's dotted. I mean, how did you convince Brooklyn Stages and
Broadway Stages
and Good Greens that this was going to work?
I think it worked out well. I don't know how much of a challenge it was. I don't know how much doubt they had, actually. But you know, we had several conversations and we put together a plan, and then it went through, and you know, I was telling them like, hey, I'm gonna quit my job next week, you know, like
are you sure this is gonna work?
Yeah, and I was sweating it, to be honest. You know, it was like, what if that check never gets written or whatever? Like, what if the truck never comes?
That's where Adam comes in, and he can basically consult.
Well, hold on just 1 second, guys. We actually got a caller on the line. Let's see if they got a question
a
for
caller.
Us.
Cool.
Hello? Do we have a caller on the line?
Yeah, hi.
Hey, who's this?
This is Andrew from Brooklyn.
Andrew from Brooklyn. What's going on, Andrew from Brooklyn? You're here with the Heritage Farm Report. You got two urban gardeners with us.
How's it going?
Hi, guys. I was calling to see which vegetables or crops you've had the most success with in your rooftop gardens. Do some things work better than others?
It's a great question. Who's going to answer that?
Both of them are going to answer.
All right,
we'll start with Adam.
Okay. Well, I say there's
It depends, again, on the situation. I've had a lot of problems with corn because of squirrels. And then I've had
corn also has a 6-foot root, so
yeah, I mean, oh, you can grow dwarf corn, but you can, you know, corn is difficult. And also I've had some problems with the broccoli and cabbage because of squirrels again, or some kind of rodents. I think it's squirrels. And other than that, I've had a lot of success with, you know, everything, tomatoes, lettuce, you know, cucumbers, melons, eggplant, anything, you know, virtually peas, beans, everything, you know.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Ben?
Actually fairly similar, but for slightly different reasons, but the same things, lettuce, tomatoes, peas, beans, eggplants, peppers, all the fruiting vegetables have been very, very prolific, tons of blossoms. And then the only thing that I've had a little bit less luck with is the Napa cabbage, the cabbages and like the long brassicas that take about 120 days, which is broccoli, cauliflower, and
same ones that he had problems with.
Yeah, exactly. Although not because of squirrels, but probably because of have to do a little bit more testing. But it's either a function of the timing or the shallowness of the soil or how we planted it. But uh-huh. Not giving up on it.
So you guys,
well, thank you for that, Colin.
Oh, yeah, thanks, like Andrew.
We'll keep going. Just wanted to say thanks and goodbye.
So how high off the ground is the roof that you're working with?
I'd say it's about 40 feet.
Yeah, because I was wondering, how do you guys get up there now to check on things? I mean, originally you needed a crane. Do you have to go from inside the building, outside the building?
Yeah, there's actually a stairway inside and a stairway outside.
Okay.
So between the two, you get up to the top.
So
a lot of steps.
So you think that rodents and things of that nature are actually getting all the way up there?
My roof's safe. It really depends on the roof and if there's tree access.
Yeah, because I've heard of a couple lower to the ground roofs that have had a couple problems with rodents.
Yeah, I think like for broccoli and things like that, it may be rats. I actually haven't seen what's eating it. I'm guessing it's squirrels because I've seen a lot of squirrels out there. But at night, you know, I'm not out there all the time. So
I mean, it would make sense. Squirrels are more deft climbers.
And there's trees on this roof I'm thinking of specifically. There's trees. This is a, you know, right up on the second floor roof. You know, another roof I'm working on has cabbage doing okay. That's a, you know, 60 feet up in the air. Ben, your roof is far. I don't think there's any trees or it's pretty safe from squirrels, right?
For the most part, yeah.
I mean, you know, squirrels, they don't really seem to bother most of these other crops I was talking about. They may take like a bite of a tomato and sort of ruin it, but they don't really like it. So,
So you touched briefly upon dwarf varieties of the same crops. Excuse me. How do you have you been modifying different crops to suit the needs of city growing more or less? Like what Ben was telling me, that you're getting into some pretty specific science. Like, talk to us about some of your mad scientist experiments that are making that are making vegetables or fruits more city friendly.
Are you talking about selective breeding and stuff like that?
Yeah, whatever you do that's weird and high tech.
Most of it's, I wouldn't call it high tech.
3D farming, what does that even mean?
Yeah.
Dwarf,
A friend of mine, Ki Shu, who also, he teaches classes on sort of backyard gardening in the East Village. He and I, we taught classes together last year, and we sort of came up with this idea of three-dimensional and four-dimensional gardening. And this, it's sort of, it's based on idea in permaculture, which is stacking functions. And essentially, agriculture, the way, you know, conventional agriculture, the way we understand it, is two-dimensional. And what I mean by that is, you know, you're farming in rows, you're out in a field, and it's sort of like it's one crop, you know, in two-dimensional space, just a bunch of rows. And, you know, by sort of mimicking a forest with multiple canopy layers, you can get sort of, you know, like tomatoes really intercropped with peppers, and then lettuce, which like more shade underneath that, and it benefits both plants because lettuce in the open sun will have a very hard time, you know, in July and August.
Wow.
Whereas if it's under some
shade,
that's
permaculture like executed to the max.
Yeah, seriously.
Wow, that's really cool.
Lorenzo, I think we have another actual caller on the line right now. You guys are popular today.
Great.
Hello.
Let's hear it. I think we might. Hello. Do you have a caller on the line? Hi. Who's this?
This is Fabrizio. I'm from Brazil. And
hey,
I have a question. Why can we grow bananas in this neighborhood?
In Brooklyn? Or in Brazil?
It's hot in New York. We should be able to grow bananas.
Yeah.
Who's got the answer?
I've grown some bananas in the city. If you have a south-facing window, and you can grow bananas that'll produce fruit. You can even buy them in the city at certain garden centers. They're sort of a miniature variety of bananas.
Do they bloom, though?
And they'll bloom, and they'll give you fruit. And I had to sort of move out of that apartment, so I sort of had to cut the experiment short. But I had good results for about a year. And you can also grow bananas. You can grow them anywhere in the city. They won't give you fruit, but you'll have some really interesting looking plants.
Nice banana leaves, right? You could cook with banana leaves.
You see them even outdoors in potters, around the city and stuff like that.
They won't survive the winter though. So
I've
because
never
bananas
seen them bloom, though.
Because they take like up to around a year, around 12 months to give you fruit. Mm. You know, they can't quite make it, but you can easily do it indoors if you have a sunny window. And cool. And that's something I'm going to be working on. I'm trying to do some tropical fruit combinations, like bonsai mangoes.
Do you have a blog or anything? Cool. How do we keep up with all these experiments that you're doing? Where do you record all this stuff? Are you going to come out with a book one day? What's your deal?
Definitely a book.
You got
it. Maybe when Ben and I, winter comes along.
Yeah, when you stop working everything.
You got to get your hands on his journal.
Yeah. I mean, I have a website. It's rooftopfood.com.
Okay.
And it's right now, it's a new one. It's mostly just sort of like class schedules and some photos and stuff.
Cool. But. So we could go to rooftopfood.com and then we could go to rooftopfarms.com, rooftopfarms.org, and rooftopfood.com.
Yeah.
Okay.
We should just combine them. Yeah. We should have,
Well, you better be linking to each other.
Thanks for the call, Fabrizio. So, but I want to get back to this point of using the garden to garden.
And but before we leave the question that we were talking about, the different corn, are you guys experimenting at all with like specific heirloom? Are you like only doing heirloom varieties? I mean, would a dwarfed corn not be considered heirloom because it's kind of modified in a sense?
Yeah, we have some dwarf corn actually too up on the roof, and it hasn't blossomed or bloomed or anything yet too, but it's doing well.
I mean, it's a dwarf. It could be heirloom, but probably not. It's probably a hybrid. I think the ones I grew are F1 hybrids. But I mean, the original corn, it comes from South America. It was about the size of it was about an inch long, an inch and a half or something. So the original corn is pretty small.
Right.
So there are heirloom dwarf corns out there.
Okay, just wondering. I mean, I always like to ask because I know we try and keep it, really diverse and try and always stick with our heirloom and keep with our heritage and, the whole network, and we always got to ask those questions.
Mm-hmm. So did you pull this concept of using the garden to garden, like, from natural models, like, rainforest models or natural, other farming models? Like, where did you come up with this idea of, like, placing the plants in different places so that they would so that the way they grow would benefit each other's growth?
To me,
that is genius.
Yeah. It's a pretty old idea. It's new to a lot of, especially, in Western farming, especially industrial farming, in the last 100 years, we've really sort of lost a lot of this traditional knowledge, and other cultures really have perfected this much further than we have. Probably the most famous example of this is called companion planting. Is another way to think about it, and that's is the Aztecs. They grew corn, squash, and beans together.
They called it the three sisters.
Exactly. That was elementary school. I'm thinking back.
Not for
now.
Me.
Yeah.
And this is all news to me.
The three sisters and the three kings.
Exactly. What were the three kings, though? Remind me, because I only remember three sisters.
I was just joking.
I thought so. I'm like, he's got to be messing with me.
And the three sisters, it's really just the corn is it's a tall stalk, and the beans can grow up it, so you don't have to provide a trellis for the beans. And then the squash goes along the ground and keeps the moisture in the soil and absorbs extra sunlight that would otherwise, hit the soil, dry it out, and be wasted. So it's like you get three sort of crops in a single space.
They work together.
And you sort of triple your output, and it's very efficient. But
is what you would recommend for your kiddie pool model?
I've tried some sort of three sisters. Like I said, I've had trouble with corn just because of squirrels. Mm-hmm. Maybe, are you trying three sisters, Ben?
Yeah, corn? We have one. It's going really well.
Yeah,
so you tried them independently schools, and with the three sister.
Yeah, except for the corn, but the beans and the squash are.
And
also
which is working better or equally well?
They're working probably equally well, but the three sisters is a really good way to like get a very dense, concentration into a small amount of area. And as Adam said, there's the synergies, and the beans, for example, have. The legumes, the bean family, they provide a lot of nitrogen to the soil,
mm-hmm.
so they actually fuel the other plants that are with them, and also I've incorporated other ideas from Adam also, actually. Like, I remember in the spring, Adam came by, we were just getting all the crops going, we had some detailed maps and everything, and it's like, tomatoes are going to be here, peppers are going to be here, and he said, I would just take handfuls of lettuce seed and just throw it.
You know? Really?
Just like cover it. Like, there's no reason why anything should be bare.
Because it would just pop up and it wouldn't really affect anything else? I mean, because there's not much of a root?
It will enrich the soil for the next round, right?
Well, it'll actually have a negative impact. I mean, it'll use up nutrients, but not a very significant
amount. And it won't kill the other plants with, like, the, you know, big roots that, well, maybe you said, what plant had, like, 6-foot roots? Was that the corn, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's...
You have to be careful where you put that, then.
Certain plants have conflicting roots. Certain plants have roots that benefit each other. So it's sort of, you have to know... And so a lot of it we just don't know about it. And what's cool about this whole field, permaculture, you know, rooftop gardening, is that there's just... Everyone's still experimenting, combining different plants together, and there's just so much, you know, so much work to be done, so much research to be done, and this is really like, you know, you're talking about the downturn, yet this is still popular. I think one of the things we learned in the downturn is that, you know, this, after all these series of bubbles we've had, you know, the tech bubble and this, it's like
internet housing,
it's like, you know, that really the innovation going on, I think, nowadays is not technological innovation. That's still going on, but it's more sort of cultural innovation, which would also be agricultural innovation.
It's almost going backwards.
Well, I think it's going forwards, but
it's going
in
forwards,
a different
but using
way.
A backwards way, you know, we're
looking
going back to our roots.
We're looking to the roots.
Pre-industrial models.
Yeah, and combining modern technology with traditional knowledge, I think, is really a way.
Better
that,
way to put it.
Is mm-hmm. really, I think, really the, you know, we're going to see a lot of that mm-hmm. coming up.
And this is one bubble. I mean, the sustainable agriculture bubble is a bubble that can't burst. I mean, it's, you know.
If we can get sustainable agriculture, then that'll solve a lot of our problems, you know.
Right.
And then.
I would think so, and hope so.
So let me ask you, from these... Sorry.
Oh, I was just going to say one other thing about having new people entering agriculture is that, they're kind of questioning old ideas and stuff, kind of like what Adam was saying, and it applies to traditional farming, too, but the more new people that try it, that get into it, you know, just like anything else, the more people that play basketball, the better the level of NBA basketball is going to be.
Sure. Yeah.
So, you know, people are coming up with new subtle ideas and breaking down old rules and stuff like that. And there's a lot of tried and tested rules that definitely are true and work, but there's always going to be something that you can do to
mm-hmm. You always got to test the system
a little bit better, yeah.
Right, and it's a numbers game. I mean, you need more people to be able to execute more little experiments, because mm-hmm. you can only do so much. You can only take so many risks with your farm because you're trying to make a living off it. You know? And
true.
You're trying
very
to make
true.
It successful.
Right.
But if you have 100 farmers and 98% of their crops, they know they can do one thing and count on them, and they have that 2% of wiggle room, you know, you have a lot more possibilities mm-hmm. for finding mm-hmm. out what works.
Yeah, and it's really important that people are communicating, that, like, you know, the conferences and, like, yeah, and, like, you know, farmers are actually using blogs and stuff like that.
So
and,
cool. Mm-hmm. I mean, I was going to ask, because I know we have to wrap this up shortly, but, like, how are you going to start, I mean, have you, or how are you going to start making money off of this? I mean, I know you said you finally left your job, pretty much, you, Ben, to do this, so
uh-huh.
is it started to become profitable now?
We've been selling everything that we've grown, and it's been
some pretty big names, right?
What's that?
Some pretty big names.
Pretty big names. I've been selling to Marlo and Sons is our first customer. They're extremely
supportive.
Now they want
supporters.
Exclusive rights.
Oh, no way!
And then Anella in the neighborhood, just around the street. I have to say that one night they called around 7 p.m. and asked if I could get them a bin of greens, and I had it to them by about 7:25.
Oh, nice.
That's pretty cool.
They were in a They probably had nothing to serve for sale that night.
That's really cool.
Yeah, but that's part of the.
It's easier than going to the store.
Too. That might be a first in New York City.
Yeah, definitely. Seriously. Maybe at Roberta. Maybe at the.
Well, I picked the first tomato too. Here at Roberta's by accident, but anyhow, I touched it and it fell off, yet. Which means it was ready, right?
And then I've also been selling a little bit to Eat Records on Messerell Street in Greenpoint.
Okay. Cool.
And then Vesta, a trattoria Italian place in Astoria, Queens.
Yeah, and there's high demand for you in the East Village. We know that.
And so now, what's the way to make this model more profitable? I mean, is it more roofs? Is it maximizing the amount of roofs we have? What's the...
I think both of those, yeah. But the farm is 6,000 square feet, and by any traditional farming standard, 6,000 square feet is...
Tiny.
Tiny, if not nothing. Yeah. But as we discussed, we're cropping it extremely aggressively. There's never more than a square inch that doesn't have something growing in it. And along those lines, we're composting very aggressively. Also, it's been really fun being resourceful. We got hair from a salon in Park Slope, which has a ton of nitrogen in it.
No way.
We're about to get a load of cocoa.
It will be composted.
It will be composted. It'll break down into pure nutrients. We're getting chocolate nibs from Mass Brothers. Acme Fish has proposed that they could give us a lot of their used dead fish for us to compost. Wow. It's really cool, and it's
really going to help the soil.
And that's part of the what also I was talking about with bringing the community together and creating this whole circular system in the city with what would elsewise be garbage. What it would get shipped to Staten Island,
right.
People are going to start giving into us.
It ingrains a different way of thinking into people's heads that it becomes commonplace, people are catching on.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Yeah. You know, one man's trash is another man's treasure.
And then the next person's meal.
Yeah, yeah. I would add to that
from trash to meal in about how many months?
Is that not sustainable?
I think it might be.
It's our ultimate resource, and we produce a lot of it in New York. So
definitely.
I mean, that's really the benefit of of one of the reasons I got into this, the benefit of rooftop farming, or community gardens or anything, producing our own food in the city. Is and why it's so green, so much, much more greener than any regular green roof that's just sitting there will do, and not that much more expensive. Or, there's cheap ways to do it as well. Is that if we have I forget how many thousands of trucks that come into the city every day, and how many thousands of trash trucks that leave every day, and the number one thing they're bringing in is food. And the top two things they're taking out is food waste and paper
and packaging,
exactly. Totally. And so basically you can, we could process the paper on site and compost it and compost the food. I mean, we could basically solve the whole urban pollution, air pollution thing. Congestion pricing, if New York City was growing its own food, which it could easily do on rooftops, aside from the beef, maybe, and the milk, we could pretty much grow all our own food on rooftops.
We could maybe do with the goats if we could drink the goat milk.
Well,
2010.
Yeah.
Up until the 50s, Central Park still had a lot of sheep, and sheep meadow. So it's... I mean, that's really where the pollution problem comes from. So it could solve, the waterway pollution as well as the air pollution.
One thing we won't be able to do is to ever stop that smell in Staten Island. No matter how much we try, it's always going to smell in Staten Island, but it's okay.
I mean, I find this fascinating. I it's so exciting to interview you two. I think you guys are super badass and at the forefront of really what is going to be the next big thing in the way people
live
in America.
I'm truly
fascinated by it.
Yeah.
We're losing land too, so people are gonna the water levels are rising. We're gonna have to start becoming more resourceful with our rooftops, and it's not just gonna be in New York City that this model is going to be recreated. Mm-hmm. It's gonna be in more places in more urban areas than just the city area that we're so familiar with.
And what we're doing is still kind of a drop in the bucket. We have to be realistic about it. But picture it if it was on every other or every roof across the whole city, then it would really be substantial.
Yeah.
And we'd be using all the hair.
The hair and amongst other things.
All the chocolate.
Yeah, I can't even imagine. Yeah.
But I mean, it's and really, you don't need thousands of dollars or even hundreds of dollars to do this. You don't even need a kiddie pool. You can any kind of container. You can go up, get on the roof
just need
one
the
way
website.
Or another. Yeah, right. Go to the website. But yeah, the classes I teach, they're all free, so
cool.
If
can you tell us your site again?
It's rooftopfood.com.
Rooftopfood.com. And you're rooftopfarms.org. Awesome.
We'll cross-link that.
if you even have an inkling of starting something on your roof, just go to these websites and just do it. Just start. See what happens. Yeah. And if you got any questions, send them to these guys.
Like my grandma says, I mean, the plants want to grow. They want to live just like people do, you know?
Yeah. We all live under this sun. Let's make it happen.
Well, this was really a landmark farm report for us.
Yeah, this is great. So
thank you guys so much for joining us.
Take care and enjoy your weekend.
Thanks for having us.
And thanks to Hearst Ranch for sponsoring this program.
Thanks, Hearst.
Bye.